the unsurpassed, penetrating and perfect truth to met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it, we can remember and accept it, vow to make this truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So, here we go. This thing has a peculiar echo. Is everything all right? Okay. What I'd like to talk about today is the Noble Eightfold Path and letting go of samsara. Now, the Noble Eightfold Path, I have trouble remembering this, which is why my little security blanket is here. Right understanding, right thought, right speech, action, and livelihood. Right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. Those are the translations of the items that Reverend Master Jiu uses in Zen's Eternal Life, and that's what I'd like to go with. I understand that concentration is often translated as meditation, but I'd like to stick with concentration. There was a teacher in the Bay Area, whom I'm sure most of you have heard of, a fellow called Shunryu Suzuki, who wrote a wonderful book called Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. This was a long time ago. And it's still in publication. It's still a very, very fine document. Beginner's mind is indispensable. People, being people, have a tendency to constantly be trying to escape, get out, progress beyond the place where they think they've just been. You know, move on. In the sense of getting better, getting out of my problems, getting out of my trouble, moving on. Life getting better. This is a difficulty. Because it runs counter to the teaching of beginner's mind. Reverend Master Jiu used to say that every day, every minute of every day, we don't begin on page one, we begin on page 000. Everybody does. Nobody has genuinely the experience of finding that they were, that they're better or wiser than they were yesterday, and that this improved wisdom and this improved behavior is a springboard that allows them to pass on further. It doesn't work that way. That's just vanity. It's the whole idea of I'm getting better and better, and one day, quite soon I hope, I'll be perfect, and then I'll be better than you. Which is the way in which that thought progress works. If we want to let go, now let's backtrack a second. It's not quite a metaphor, actually it's a description of a vision, but we'll call it a metaphor for the time being. There's a metaphor in Buddhism that speaks of crossing to the other shore. As though human beings were on this shore, which is the shore of suffering and confusion, and on the other side, way out there, almost out of sight, but not quite, there is the other shore, which is the shore of nirvana, wisdom, understanding, where everything is nice. And that in between, there is an ocean or a river, but a great patch of water. And that the function of training is to let go of this shore and cross over. Now, there are a lot of conceptual mistakes that are going to arise out of this metaphor, unfortunately, but still it holds good, despite all of our erroneous ways of interpreting it. The important thing is simply letting go of the shore we feel we're on, constantly letting go of where we are, cutting the tether that ties us to the anchor or to the the wharf or the jetty or the whatever it is that has us anchored. Just let it go. Cutting the rope is perhaps a slightly aggressive image for it, actually, because letting go is a very gentle business. In fact, a practice of gentleness and of modesty and of self-awareness is the cutting of the rope. So it isn't done with savagery or with aggressive definiteness. Instead, it's done gently. We have to do this constantly, and this is beginner's mind. Just letting go of where we are. Don't worry about where you're going to go. Don't worry about paddling to the other shore or whatever vehicle you're going to be on as you go. All that stuff kind of solves itself. Just let go of where we are. It isn't making progress. In a sense, nothing changes. We just let go of where we are. Dogen wrote this difficult chapter, among other difficult chapters, called, I think it's the Bendowa, in which he tries to describe what awakening is. One of the most important things he says is that with awakening, with the letting go of the tether that ties us, not a dust mote moves. Not an iota of reality shifts. Zero. Nothing happens. Okay? Nothing is destroyed. No self disappears. No vast turning over of the world occurs. These are images of disturbance that are not altogether inappropriate, which I'm going to get back to, but be careful of them. Actually, nothing moves. Not a thing. You are exactly the same person you were. And the world is exactly the same world that it was when you wake up. So what's waking up? Well, that's an amazingly good question because it doesn't really have an answer. Something happens and yet nothing happens. Beginner's mind does not disappear when you wake up. Beginner's mind, the mind that the first person walks in the door, okay? Never been here before. Never been in a Buddhist temple before, never attempted to meditate before, hasn't a clue. Doesn't know anything about what we do here. That mind does not change. It doesn't disappear. It doesn't suddenly get better. It doesn't clarify. Nothing happens. Even when we die, nothing happens. It's not that nobody cares. It's that actually nothing happens. It's not a state of negligence or overlooking something. It's that nothing happens. And yet something happens. And it is very hard to say what that is. When we let go of the tether that ties us to the shore of samsara, samsara doesn't go away. And we do not depart from it. And yet something happens. In the middle of this, nothing happens. There is a difference. The Eightfold Path was described by Shakyamuni Buddha as eight aspects of behavior and of living that help us let go of the tether. They are themselves the letting go of the tether. And it takes a while. Let's begin with right understanding. it is very easy to fall into the delusion that there are certain prerequisite concepts that you need to think a lot about, perhaps even get a grasp on, before you can be a Buddhist. And this just isn't true. There's nothing you need to have under your belt before you begin to meditate. All you have to do is want to. And wanting doesn't really belong to you. It's kind of a current that flows through you, like all wanting. Very hard to explain, wanting. Desire, very, very difficult to define. But it's there. And if you want to meditate, that's all there is to it. You'll find out pretty soon whether or not you want to continue. But you don't need to have a prerequisite conditioning of your opinions and thoughts ahead of time. In fact, that's one of the obstacles we create for ourselves. The idea that we have to know something before we can take a step. That we have to know where we're going before we go there. This is just simply hesitation and doubt. There's no adventure in it. You know, believe me, Buddhism is an adventure. I can remember when I first, I've told this story, God knows how many times, when I first came here, shortly before I first came here, I remember thinking to myself, you know, one of my reasons for coming here is that I think it's going to be fun. And that's, you know, I've spent a number of times in the last 30 plus years thinking that's a pretty shallow reason for entering a monastery, but I keep coming back to it. It doesn't go away. It has to be an adventure. Otherwise, it's just you're stuck in the same old room. Nasty little dark room you feel you were stuck in. And there you are. Adventure is getting out of it. It involves walking without feet. It involves a constant state of being slightly off balance, of sensing that there's something wrong here all the time. Don't imagine that Buddhism is going to make you feel right or balanced all the time or like it's okay now, because it doesn't. What it gives you is the practice of walking, where you're on one foot all the time. So long as you're walking, you're never standing on 2 feet. You're always on one, and you're in transition, constant transition. And in fact, you're very close to falling over all of the time. And this is the cutting of the rope. It's okay. We seem to be scared to death of this, which is why fear is so much the focus of our training. Overcoming our responses, our knee-jerk responses to fear. You know, acting on fear. The fear isn't necessarily going to go away, incidentally. It may be part of the imbalance that lasts forever. So don't imagine that one day you're going to wake up and all the fear is gone. That is not necessarily viable. But you don't have to act on it. Learning to accept the profound discomfort of the adventure, but don't knee-jerk act on the discomfort, is the trick. And so that sounds a little generalized, so we'll come back to details on that. Right understanding, therefore, is not a matter of getting out the roadmap and figuring out where you're going in advance before you go. It's a matter of just going. Meditation, as we all experience it, is a disturbing business because it doesn't really meet our expectations. Our thoughts come and go, and we get upset about it. As Dogen said, weeds grow in the garden, and we hate to see them grow. But there they are. Nothing comes up kind of clean and tidy. Meditation for most people, most of the time, provokes a tinge of disturbance mixed with disappointment, mixed with, gee, I could have done better. Gee, that wasn't so good, was it? Gee, that was a waste of time. It goes down from hill from there to the point where people give it up because they think it's supposed to make them impermeable. They think meditation is supposed to protect you against the world and against suffering. It's supposed to lock samsara into a box so that you can throw it away and get rid of it. And meditation won't let us do any of that stuff. It keeps on being the unpredictable thing that it is. Meditation is just us looking at the paintwork. You know, there's nothing there, is there? There isn't a thing called meditation. It's just us. Who we are is the thing we find out a little bit about as we go along. But there isn't a method or a strategy or a plan or a map or a thought process or a thing happening there that does the work for us. It's just us. You know, with a face on our heads and hands on the end of our arms and our feet and our legs get sore and we wear clothes that don't quite fit and we have to breathe and the heart keeps beating and we get hungry. And then there's all the other stuff in the mind. We get peaceful for a little while and then we get bored. And we get agitated and then we get excited. And then our anticipations build and we think, gee, I'm sure it's about to happen to me any minute now. And it goes on like this, okay? It's not merely good to learn about all of the peculiar things we go through and then kind of remember them and know, oh yeah, that's that again. That's all very well. But it doesn't matter as much as simply breathing and letting it go. You actually don't have to learn anything in meditation either, any more than you actually have to learn anything from this Dharma talk. You don't even have to remember what I'm saying. Meister Eckhart said, in awakening, we don't have anything, we don't want anything. We don't know anything, and we don't want to know anything. We're like we were the day before we were born. There's no achievement there. There's no vehicle to carry us. It's just like the day before we were born. Beginner's mind. Actually, page 000. Before you reach page one. The original face, they say. The face you had before your parents were born. In this week, Rev. Master Mayan is going to be conducting a retreat on cultivating the empty field. And the fellow who wrote that, Great Master Hongshi, uses original face as the face for the people he's talking to. That face, that face, that face, all original face. He speaks to He speaks very personally to the trainees who are right in front of him. And he says, you know, you with the original face, do this. You with the original face, behave this way, it'll work out. You with the original face, let go of this, that, the other thing. Whatever his instruction happens to be at the time. He just speaks to people as the original face. He's not kidding himself that they are wonderful trainees. He's just saying, everybody has the original face. Let's talk a little bit about right thought. We have this tendency to judge our thoughts because they seem to trouble us. Some of them we like and some of them we don't like. Because we like to approve of ourselves, we like thoughts that are approvable. Nice thoughts, good thoughts, kind thoughts, constructive thoughts. And it makes us unhappy to find that we are also cruel and vicious and vengeful and greedy and all the other stuff. So, we like to prune out the stuff we think we and God don't approve of and hold on to the stuff we prefer. This doesn't work. Exhaustion, if it's necessary, will drive this delusion out of us. One of the reasons why people stop meditating and go do something else is because they get exhausted. It wearies them to do the work because they're fighting the work. The exhaustion alone, just in and of itself, is one of our best friends in religion. It catches, it's the safety net. There may be ways to break through to understanding before we become exhausted. But if there aren't, the exhaustion will get us in the end. We can't lose. That doesn't mean it's a lot of fun. Exhaustion is exhaustion. It does not feel good. Learning to accept, learning that you cannot resist the evil current of thought, and that you cannot hold on to the so-called good current of thought, provokes all kinds of things. Disappointment, anger, self-hatred. We blame other people. We blame our parents, of course. We blame our karma. Poor old karma. He seems to be responsible for everything. And he's not. We blame our senses, nasty senses. Wish they would go away. It's so much nicer to die. That's one of the things that Shakyamuni used to have to discourage some of his disciples with regard to. He said, you know, clinging to life, you know that's not a good thing. But don't try clinging to death. That doesn't work either. Don't try to die. Don't try to live as though you were dead. Dogen used to say the same thing too. He'd run into a few pieces that Chinese masters had said under a different context, and they'd said it quite well. They said, become like a dead tree. Become like dead ashes. Like a rock at the bottom of a cliff. Just sit there. And Dogen would have to say to his trainees all over again, don't try to be like dead ashes. It doesn't work. Don't try to be a dead tree. Don't try to imagine you're a rock. None of that works. You have to live. You have to live as dead ashes. You have to live as a dead tree. You still have to sweep the floor. You still have to eat, go to the bathroom, sleep at night. Do the ordinary things of life. Think with your mind. Don't be afraid of thoughts. Don't imagine that the constructive acts of living, which involve writing and talking and thinking and doing and planning, don't imagine that these run counter to the spirit of meditation. They're just simply things that you let go of when you sit facing the wall. And then you pick them up again, as though they were as empty as the paint on the wall, and as meaningless as looking at a dead flat surface. Our own senses are remarkable. The one that seems to work with me most of the time is the eyes. But I found that because we can see, because I can see the floor, I can see chairs, I can see a glass of water, because I can see these things, I am completely blind. There is no seeing through. There is no transparency that is usable. There is occasionally a gift of transparency. You want to be careful with it. The physical world, the walls, the roof, we see them and they blind us. Dead blind. We don't see anything else. I don't see God in the room. Does anybody else see God in the room? No. I don't see any angels either. Don't seem to be a lot of bodhisattvas, okay? It's just the room. And that will do. Just see the room. And you become blinded to preconceptions, expectations, greeds, anxieties. All of it goes blind. And then you can see whatever there is. It is possible to see the true room, which is the room. Remember, not a dust mote moves when you wake up. The room does not disappear when you wake up. Nothing moves. Bodhisattvas don't come pouring out of the mouse holes. It's just the room. Blindness is the same as seeing. I say these peculiar things, not because they, you know, point to some kind of mystic reality or anything, but because I find it, myself anyway, helpful, enormously helpful to remind myself in words that my blindness works, that ignorance and not knowing what's going on, works, that just this works. Beginner's mind works. Advanced mind doesn't. It's a dead loss. But beginner's mind works. It does not mean we're fools. It means something else altogether. Let's move on to right action and speech and livelihood. Speech in particular. Because speech comes easier. And actually we do more of it than just about anything else. Speech is action, and so is thought. One of the main teachings in the Eightfold Path about speech is that it is good to be polite and modest in your speech, to tell the truth, not to speak absurdly or out of time or out of place. That's where Shakyamuni set people moving. He said, watch your tongue. Be careful with your speech. Don't betray it or yourself by indulging in a whole lot of rubbish. Shakyamuni had a way of not telling you what the next step was. And he left it to you. People like Dogen have a way of actually telling you a bit about the next step. I think it's one of the ways in which Theravada and Mahayana tend to diverge from each other slightly. Is the Mahayana crowd tend to talk beyond the initial instruction. Because the question has to arise when you are modest and careful with your speech is, what do you do with all the other stuff? The impulse to speak rudely, cruelly, to cuss, to make a fuss, to say things out of time and out of place, to make a mess with your tongue, to make a mess with your actions, to make a mess with your livelihood. What do you do with that? Some people interpret from Shakyamuni's words that what you're supposed to do is cut it all off and dump it or send it to hell or something and hold on to the good only and get rid of the evil. okay, you know, there is a way in which you do that. There is an aspect of the training in which you do something a little like that. But you don't send it to destruction, because you can't. Remember, not a dust mote moves. You can't send anything to hell. It's not possible. It doesn't move. You can't destroy things. They just won't undo. It's not even within the power of God to take the world apart. Can't be done. There is a flow of good speech and good action within us, and there is an equal flow of evil speech and evil action. Some people see it like a river, like two rivers, that they can actually see. I've seen that. I had a very bad experience. Well, not bad, a terrible word. I had a difficult experience with this about a dozen years ago. Went on for quite some time. Probably there are many people in the room who have had the same very clear, very tangible experience of these two rivers running within themselves. Most people, I think, don't. But everybody's well aware of our potential, that second by second we can turn to the right or turn to the left. And sometimes we turn this, unfortunately, into a struggle, trying to do the right thing, trying to crush the wrong thing. This is exhausting. Eventually the exhaustion catches up with us and we find we don't have the energy or any kind of wherewithal to keep this struggle up. And the evil flow creeps in as a lesson. That's what it did for me. It crept in and I could not say anything that anyone could bear to listen to. The only thing I could do was shut up. Didn't say anything for quite a while. Pretty much nothing. I had to. You do have to put a cap on the outward manifestation of the evil flow. You can't give it license. You can't let it out. But you cannot stop it flowing. It doesn't flow to anywhere in particular, but it flows. You cannot stop this green slime river from flowing. Don't try. When you try, you will become exhausted, and then you will have to let it flow, because you won't have the wherewithal to stop it. It mixes with the so-called good flow, if you let it. Your Master Ji used to speak a lot about mixing and melding. Put the whole lot, she said, into a pot and heat the pot. Cook it. She used the metaphor of cook. Actually, it wasn't a metaphor. But she used the image of cooking as a way of describing meditation a lot, particularly after 76. You put everything in. You're not picky and choosy about what goes in the pot. You put the lot in. And just let it muck up. You don't need within yourself to distinguish between good and evil. In your behavior, you do. This is one of those seemingly uncomfortable paradoxes that good old Zen has a habit of dumping on us. You know, Zen is often equated with this paradox thing. We think it's the koan. Okay, yeah, it's true. You can't get away from it. You have to do something that is a little different from what's actually happening inside you. And yet they're not at war with each other, and you can do this. It's hard to think about. It's hard to make sense of. It's tremendously difficult to speak about or to write about, and generally speaking, people should avoid doing so. But you can do it. It's part of letting go of the tether that ties us to samsara. Is to do this, to allow the whole lot to cook together in one pot. It's uncomfortable because it involves memory. Memories we'd rather not have. Memories of things we have done and ways we have been in the past. Things we hope we have grown out of, but have not. Nobody ever grows out of anything. It doesn't go away, remember? That dust mote that never moves? Nothing goes away. I am as much of a emotional, tantrumizing infant as I ever was. And it's very important to put that in the pot and let it cook. It's very disturbing because you, when you do it, you can feel yourself turn to jelly. Like there's no backbone. All my life I've had a problem with the matter of apologizing for things. Of admitting that I did something. Big screw up, hide it. Okay? Don't admit to it, hide it. That was always my impulse. Because I wanted to grow up and be good and be powerful and visible and all that rubbish. Which of course doesn't work. So the recollection of things I have done in my past and ways I have been makes me turn to jelly. I can feel the jelly shaking. Okay? That's okay. This is really uncomfortable. You immerse yourself in it. You know, to immerse oneself in the practice is the Eightfold Path. You can't think your way through this. You can't know things. You just immerse yourself in the practice. You immerse yourself in yourself. There was a wonderful book written by a fellow called Joseph Conrad called Lord Jim. Quite a lot of you have probably read it. It was written back around the turn of the 19th, 20th century. It was about people who, or one person in particular, who was terribly disappointed with himself for being the person he was. He longed to be good, to be courageous, to be stable, and he wasn't. He turned to mush every time something arose, and he kept running away from it. Very visibly. It's kind of an adventure story in a way. It takes place in the South Pacific. But he kept trying to avoid dealing with the matter. And eventually he managed to. But there's one character in that book who's an old man, an old Dutchman, doesn't speak very good English, collects butterflies. He had had a very checkered past. But it involved a lot of violence, a lot of disturbance. And he had learned the hard way. And the advice he gave for the solution of Jim's difficulty was, in the destructive element, immerse. He said it backwards because his English wasn't very good. In the destructive element, immerse, swim in it. That's kind of what beginner's mind is. In the destructive element, immerse. You are your own destructive element and there's plenty there. Just immerse. It's really uncomfortable. It's the way to go. It's how we cut the rope. Right livelihood, right action. There are a lot of things we shouldn't do. And we pretty much know what they are. We have precepts. They are guidelines, strong guidelines, regarding things like killing and lying and stealing and messing up sexually and getting angry and all the rest of it. Things we should avoid. And we try to keep those precepts. If we do not try earnestly to keep the precepts, then our effort never concentrates, never sharpens, our awareness remains dull. We don't come alive enough to make the true effort to cut the rope. We're just not alive enough if we don't try to keep those precepts. The fact that most of the time we're not successful in keeping them is beside the point. We're not out for success. There's something else going on. The purpose is to be alive with the destructive element. Immerse. Try to keep the precepts. It's the only thing that can keep us awake through the dullness, through the no state of crisis, the no emergency happening today, the tendency to sleep through it. The precepts will help keep us awake, remind us of who we really are, as opposed to the person we sort of daydream we'd like to be. And help to wake us up. And they remind us of that evil flow within that has to flow. You just don't let the cat out of the bag. Try not to. Try not to give action to the impulses. Try not to go splat with the difficulty. Try not to let the green slime run over everybody else. They've got their own green slime. They're trying not to let their green slime run over you. This is a good thing. This is the foundation for mutual respect and for sympathy. We understand, you know, how many of us are there in the room? You know, 50 or something, right? We have this terrible tendency to think that everybody else in the room is not like us. You know, we're kind of stuck here on our own, and other people, whoever they are or whatever they are different. But actually, we're all in the same boat. We all suffer from the same impulses, the same flows, the same koan, and the same practice. It's there for everybody. It's shared. And yet the responsibility is individual. We don't do each other's work for it, the other person. And we can't do another person's work for them. But we can do our own. Let's move on to right effort. This is an interesting one. Effort is beyond definition. In the destructive element, immerse. Just immerse yourself in the training. Immerse yourself in the practice. Immerse yourself in yourself. This works. Hard to put a definition on that, isn't it? An example might help. Years and years and years ago, when I was a layperson, actually, I wasn't even a layperson. It was before I'd heard of Reverend Master Jiu, but I hadn't come here. This was back in England. I went to a seven-day Sesshin retreat conducted by a Japanese monk in London. And I'd had a number of things that had happened previous to that that reminded me of the green slime flow. I'd run into a serious encounter with my own weakness. And I figured, you know, religion was the way to go. So anyway, I attended this retreat. And I put a hell of a lot of effort into it. 7 days. First 3 days. You know how sometimes you find during a session that actually you seem to be able to get a bit of mastery over your thoughts? You know, you begin to find that you can sit, and if you sit very intensely, they don't seem to trouble you so much. They do seem to recede. They seem to sort of come under control or something or other, and you can sit through it. You know, you can handle it. This lasted for the first 3 days. The morning of day 4, it all fell to bits. The thoughts came in rivers. There was no question of controlling. Somehow or other, I just run out of oomph. And this stuff just ran like water. It wasn't evil and it wasn't good. It was just thoughts. You know how it is? With it, just one thing leads to another, to another, to another, to another, to another, to another, and it just goes on, like water running down a drain. I tried really hard for the first 3 days to sit there. And on day four, well, I was still sitting there, but it was just like the slush running through. It wasn't particularly painful, peculiarly enough. I wouldn't quite call it a relief, because it was sort of a disappointment. It was dismaying. I'd never run into anything quite like this before. It was dismaying. And then lunchtime came. We had lunch, which wasn't very big. Never was. And I went for a walk. And on the way back from the walk, I woke up. Now, it wasn't any big deal, and it didn't last. But I did wake up. And it had something to do with effort. And the what? The dissipation of effort? The disappearing of effort? What is it? How much effort are you putting in when your thoughts just run like water down a drain? Is that effort or is that absence of effort? Or is this how? I don't know. But it worked. And obviously there were a lot of factors involved. But it made me think it's impossible to put your finger on right effort. Back in the old days when I first came here, one of the things the teachers used to say was, Shakyamuni Buddha is the classic case. He spent 6 years in ascetic practices and in disciplining his mind as rigorously as he could. And after about 6 years, he packed it in. Had a decent meal for the first time in a while, and then sat under the tree and it worked. Okay, we all know that story. All right? And they said, I remember the guest master in particular used to say, it's impossible to say what contributed to his final enlightenment. Was it all the mistaken efforts he had made? Was it the asceticism, which he later on told us wasn't any good? Was it his leaving home? Was it just his sitting under the tree? What is it that worked? What was the effort that did the job? And you don't know. We just don't know. So practice right effort without picking and choosing. Just immerse yourself in the practice. That's all. It's messy enough. It's a lovely mess. There it is. Right mindfulness. Mindfulness, we have this tendency to say to ourselves, if I was mindful, I wouldn't have dropped my food on the floor. If I was mindful, I wouldn't be making mistakes. If I paid attention, I'd be good all the time. If I was mindful, I wouldn't let the cat out of the bag. If I was mindful, I would restrain myself all the time. If I was mindful, my training wouldn't seem to fall down. Things would not seem to go wrong. That's not mindfulness. That's building a fortress against yourself. That's using mindfulness, supposedly, to protect yourself against the facts. And it does not work. It's also a profound misuse of life to live in a state of constant self-defense. You have to defend yourself against some things. You put a raincoat on when it rains. And once in a while, you need to make sure that nobody bugs you when you go to your room to catch a nap, because you need a nap really badly sometimes. And you don't let the dog bite you, and you eat your meals and stuff like that. These are protective devices designed to keep us alive, keep us balanced enough to be able to continue and moving on to the next day without too much paranoia. Okay? We can live that way. It's beyond that that the trouble starts. When we start to defend ourselves against ourselves. I have this wonderful little disease, autoimmune hepatitis. Nobody can explain it. Nobody really knows why the immune system decides to attack the body it lives in. And yet it happens to a lot of people. And I tend to get inflammation problems in various limbs of my body, particularly in my liver. And basically what I'm doing is attacking myself. I refuse to credit the idea that this is just a mechanism that is acting mechanically. I don't buy it. This is my fault. Okay, I'm doing this to myself. I have looked into the matter, shall we say, and I'm responsible. It's not just a mindless behavior of the body. There's something going on here that I cause. Not that I have caused, I continue to cause it. We attack ourselves. We attempt to defend ourselves against ourselves. We try to create a spiritual immune system, and in the process, we start demolishing our own ability to be comfortable or to get a night's sleep or to use our hands because at the end of the day, they wind up hurting too much and, you know, you have to take prednisone. Don't misuse mindfulness. Don't use it as a weapon against yourself. For Pete's sake, don't accuse other people of not being mindful because they dropped their lunch, or not being mindful because, oh, gee, I forgot to ring the bell, or etc. Okay? It really doesn't pay. You're dealing in lies when you think this way. Once I was out at Fugain Hermitage, this was a couple of years ago, and you know, when you're alone for the first time in a while, and it's a really nice place, okay? There's forest, there's animals, there's bears, there's birds, there's nice sun in the sky, and you've got some nice things to do, and plenty of etc., all that kind of situation, the mind begins to feel good. Okay? You just feel good. You wake up in the morning thinking, ah, yes, it's nice. And so you start living your day. Yes, it's lovely. And pretty soon you find that actually what's going on, what I found anyway, is that what I'm writing on here is past experiences of feeling good as well. This recollection of nice stuff from the past, some of it a long way back. Basically, what we're dealing with is a kind of nostalgia episode where the mind is sort of swimming in something that's yummy. And I let it go. I just let it go. And you know, snap, it disappeared. And instead, actuality was there. And boy, that was so much better. It was clear. The things that were there, were there. Let go of nostalgia. Let go of good feelings. Don't try to feel good. It's a complete diversion. It's a misuse of the mind, misuse of life, misuse of all of the opportunity that life offers to us, trying to feel good. Which doesn't stop you from enjoying your bread pudding. That's fine. You just let it go. Once it's in your mouth, it doesn't belong to you anymore, in case you've never noticed. And you don't really want to meet it again after it's entered your mouth anyway. So let it go. Let all good feelings go. If you can let go of them when they press upon you, It's amazing how bright the world can suddenly appear, how lucidly present it can be, how trustworthy, in a way that nostalgia, believe me, is not. The photograph album, the pictures of the kids. I have pictures of my kids on my desk to remind me that they're still there somewhere and that I probably should call them once in a while. Otherwise, I think I'd forget them. So I have the reminders there so that I don't forget. But I don't sit there going gooey-eyed at 10 o'clock at night over my grandchildren. As far as I'm concerned, they're somebody else's kids. Right concentration. Now, I choose concentration rather than meditation. Because of some, well, never mind. But let's stick with concentration. Like all of the Eightfold Path, but most lucidly in this particular case, concentration is a gift. It comes straight out of the empty circle, straight out of emptiness. You can't, you know, tunnel vision doesn't work. It works sometimes when you're having to con. You know, when I'm doing electrical wiring, I kick other people out of the room because I just cannot do. I can't deal with problems of electrocution and electric fire while somebody is trying to tell me about how much they enjoyed their lunch. Or, you know, really I should relax more or something. I didn't get out of here. I've got to do the wiring. Okay, I've got to, that's what tunnel vision is for. And then you let it go. Right concentration is not tunnel vision. Tunnel vision is an artifice that we cannot bear for very long. And I'm sure there's actually somewhere rather than which you don't have to do it at all, but I haven't found one yet. Right concentration is way beyond definition. I could talk about it being things like breadth of mind or openness or allowing the world to be as it is. We could say a lot of things, all right? None of it very helpful. We feel our way through these things a little at a time. But defining it really doesn't help. It seems like a gift. Like meditation itself. Shakyamuni Buddha taught about cause and effect. That everything has a cause, and everything is a cause, and that all of life is a continuous chain of cause, effect, cause, effect, cause, effect, cause, effect. That this is just the way existence is. And when he told that to some of his disciples, merely hearing that, they woke up. Just to hear that life was cause and effect was sufficient to awaken some people. Hidden within the doctrine of cause and effect, within the doctrine of karma, is the teaching that actually cause and effect itself arises from the empty circle and returns to the empty circle. That there is a source that isn't a cause. It's just a source. The Buddha, the empty circle, doesn't cause anything. And he doesn't indulge in effect. But he is the source and the ground and the destination of all things. But it's not the same as karma. It's not the same as cause and effect. When we try to look at our meditation and our practice and say that such and such a behavior causes awakening, we are deluded. Because it doesn't. Awakening is best thought of as a gift. It comes straight out of the empty circle. It does not pass through anything on its way. And in fact, all of life is thus. Every scrap, every dust mote, all of those dust motes that never move, they leap straight out of the empty circle into karma. And then back into the empty circle. Cause and effect and the complete absence of cause and effect are perfectly in harmony with each other. As Billy Blake used to say, eternity is in love with the productions of time. When we think of the Eightfold Path as ways in which we can construct or cause our own awakening, we're headed for a bad time. We will become exhausted. The safety net will catch us. But it's a rough piece of ground to enter into. I would recommend you don't do it. Of course you will. Everybody does. But trying to think and plan and plot your own training with the anticipation that doing certain things will cause awakening is ingratitude, radical misunderstanding, misuse of life. Karma, cause and effect, deliberate action, the regulation of one's behavior, the restraining of oneself, are our service to the empty circle, offered freely without anticipation of a payoff. We just pay our dues. We do these things for their own sake. We do the best we can for the sake of the best we can, not for the consequence. Do not attempt to accumulate merit, is a thing that Hongxi used to say quite often, and it'll probably be coming up during the upcoming retreat. The accumulation of merit, the storing of the stuff, the hoarding it for one's personal purposes, is not the path. Don't try to keep stuff. Don't try to manufacture the good stuff. Like a squirrel with nuts, so that you can live on it later. Just accept the gift and reciprocate, in a sense, by offering yourself and all of the things we do, the training we do, simply as a gift to the empty circle. This is what Rinpoche Master Gyu used to call training for training's sake. Training for the sake of the empty circle. When we train for the sake of society, for the sake of self and other, those are ways of putting it. But we can only think that way very briefly. We can think that way. We can train for the sake of our friends and for our enemies and for ourselves and for a society at large. We can train for those things, but we have to let it go right away. Just allow a thought to arise, allow the intention to arise, and then let it go. Just to train for the empty circle is this. You just let go of the provisional intentions and allow it to just fall into the open place. Jesus used to say, use your life like a loaf of bread. Break it up into little bits, throw it on the water, walk away. It'll come back to you. But that isn't quite cause and effect. You don't throw it out there so it will come back. You just throw it out there, you walk away. Just throw it on the water. Don't push it any further. Don't push it. Don't expect. I got to call it quits.